House Committee on Business and Labor, and we have a lighter load than anticipated today, because some nice people just don't know which side they are on some bills sometimes, and drive me to distraction. Not this first bill we're going to hear. This is a great bill. I'm going to public hearing on House Bill 2826.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2826 exempts children under the age of 16 from the current statutory limitation on hours of work between June 1st and Labor Day and any vacation period of five or more consecutive school days in a school year. There's no fiscal or revenue on the original bill. There is a dash one amendment, which I believe Representative Olson will be out explaining.
Good morning, Representative.
There's no fiscal amount either.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Andy Olson. I'm state representative out of the Albany area.
Yes.
And, Mr. Chair, appreciate you jumping on board and sponsoring this bill with me. But I'm just going to read my testimony here. I think you have that in front of you. This is a pretty simple bill. House Bill 2826 is the Youth Opportunity and Responsibility Bill. It's bipartisan legislation that allows Oregon youth to experience the benefits of having a job. House Bill 2826 is fairly simple. First, it gives the commissioner the authority to issue special permits to youth under the age of 16 to work. Secondly, it allows youth under 16 to work until 7 p.m. and then between June 1st through Labor Day extends the hours to 9 p.m. This bill does not weaken or undermine Oregon's child labor laws. In fact, it brings our labor laws into line with what the U.S. Department of Labor laws are. It's a simple measure giving youth an opportunity to learn how to work, earn money, and manage their time. This House bill will also help appropriately prepare youth for the demands of higher education, advanced careers, and adulthood. A driving force behind this bill is gaining life experience, because employers recognize how important it is to have applicants or candidates who have life experiences that can be applied towards personal careers. Several years ago, Brad Avakian and I sat next to each other on the House floor, and during some of our conversation, we discussed the issue of wanting to move something and co-sponsoring of a bill similar to this one right here. Basically, to return kids to the berry fields, to get them picking beans again, and just get them out of the house. We are concerned that youth today are not having the same opportunity that was afforded to many of us years ago to develop a great work ethic. And actually, Mr. Chair, I'd be curious as to how many folks on your committee ever did pick berries. God bless you, you're great Americans. Okay.
I didn't pick berries, Representative, but I walked beans and detasseled and shoveled manure and other things. And
okay, that's
shelled corn.
Thank you.
any number of fun activities out in the.
You forgot about the pear industry.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, that may not bode well.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I need to move on.
You see what you've unleashed, Representative?
Very good.
We want the bill to pass.
Anyways, House Bill 2826 gives Oregon youth the same opportunities that many of us enjoyed when we were young. I'm pleased to say that my former House colleague, Labor Commissioner Brad Avakian, fully supports this bill, as well as the Oregon Farm Bureau. And the dash ones do some cleanup to what the original bill was, and if you need any further discussion on that, I can provide that with you.
Well, first of all, Representative, I'm grateful you gave me the opportunity and came to me and talked to me about this, because I couldn't agree more. As I just said, I grew up, and you know, it isn't like we're forcing children to work here. We're giving them the opportunity to work. And I just can't imagine anything better when it comes to an education than giving kids the opportunity to go out and find out exactly how hard it is to make a buck, and give them the experience of seeing how hard their parents and their grandparents and everybody else in their dog in this country works to make that buck. And I think it's just been a disservice to them to deny them the opportunity to do that. So I just want to thank you for coming here and bringing this bill, and it has my undying support. So with that, any questions of the good representative Esquivel, then Colby.
Yes, actually, thank you, Mr. Chair. This kind of comes out of what we've been discussing a little bit with our workforce development, is that a youth today does not have the life skills nor the ability to show up for a job, to be responsible in that job, in the work, to be on time. And this, I think, has a lot to do with that we've taken this opportunity away from our youth, and yet we expect them to have the life skills and responsibilities of a job. In fact, when I was on the RCC curriculum committee, the thing that came out of that committee was astounding. They wanted to have a class that taught our children how to be responsible, to come to work, to balance a checkbook, and have the life skills that they should have anyway, but they are lacking, and they wanted to teach that in college. And this will give our youth an opportunity to have that. Thank you for the bill.
Thank you.
Representative Holby, please.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. I like the concept, being one that picked berries and cherries, filberts, beans, and a few other assorted things back when we used to grow them. I'm curious, are kids under this bill, are they, when Representative Schaffler referred to them making a buck, are they going to be able to get the unemployment, or excuse me, the minimum wage and with the those sorts of things, and are they going to collect overtime for hours over eight and all that?
You know, actually, I don't know that for a fact, but I do have Kate Newhall here from...
Just for the record, just relax, Kate. The Bureau is back there nodding yes, and the bill would have a lot of trouble in this committee if the answer to that question was no.
That's why I asked, Mr. Chair. I just didn't see it in the bill.
Yeah, it's been the same.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's an excellent question, Representative, and I'm damn glad you asked it. Any more questions of a good representative before we let him go? All righty then. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to testify on behalf of this bill? Because we intend to work it right now. There's no fiscal. We have the amendment in front of us. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 2826? All right. Seeing no one, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2826. I'm going to open work session on House Bill 2826.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash ones to House Bill 2826.
Representative Cameron moves dash one amendment into House Bill 2826. Is there any discussion on the amendment motion? Representative Thatcher.
Can we just, for the record, review exactly what the amendment does?
Teresa, you want to go over that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher. The dash one amendment clarifies that the Commission of the Bureau of Labor Industries, not the Wage and Hour Commission, that's currently written in statute, is responsible for issuing special permits for children under the age of 16 that are performing agricultural work as outlined in current statute. The amendment also changes the standard end time for a child under the age of 16 to work from 6 p.m., which is the current statute, 7 p.m., and also establishes the standard end time is 9 p.m. when working between the hours of June 1st and Labor Day. And the amendment also deletes the provision that would allow the exemption for the for vacation over five consecutive school days in school year.
Yeah. All right. Any further questions, comments, concerns?
Mr. Chairman.
Any opposition? Representative Witt.
Yeah, just a question here. Is the Bureau of Labor and Industries oversight on this issuing the permits consistent with the work permits that are currently issued for underaged workers?
Ms. Hammond, Ms. Newhall, one of you want to come up and please answer that question?
The reason I'm asking, Mr.
Good
Chairman, is because it becomes difficult for employers at some point, if we're dealing with different agencies, to know who they need to go to get a permit, and I just hope it's consistent.
I couldn't agree more. Thank you. Go ahead.
Mayor Schaffler, Representative Witt. Currently, the law requires the Bureau to issue a permit in order for a...
Oh, Christy. Your name.
Christine Hammond, Administrator of the Wage and Hour Division of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. This would delete the requirement for the commissioner to approve each and every minor working until 7 o'clock p.m., so that is consistent.
Thank you. Any further questions of the department while we have them here? That was an excellent question. Thank you. Any other discussion? Is there any opposition to the amendment motion? And Representative Edwards is excused. So with that, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2826 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2826 as amended floor due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
It's a good bill.
Is there any opposition to the motion? Representative Edwards is excused. So moved. And I would wonder if the good Representative Olson would allow me to carry this with him on the floor. Thank you. All right. Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2826. And we can just go right in order now.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm just carrying that.
Okay. That's fine. You just need to announce it then.
Yes. House Bill 2633, we're going to have a work session on it today. But there's some questions about referral to Ways and Means on a long list of bills, and this is one of them. And so House Bill 2633, because of the Ways and Means question, is going to be carried over until to a date to be announced. So we're not going to work that today. And then I'm going to go to a work session in House Bill 2418.
Mr. Chair, committee members, we first heard House Bill 2418 on February 18th. The original measure adds certain legal entities and persons affiliated with these entities to the list of parties that are exempt from real estate licensing law. You have in front of you a -4 amendment which addresses issues that were raised during the first hearing. The amendment removes the term domestic partnership from the measure, which is following the standard that was established by Attorney General Hardy Myers regarding the implementation of the Oregon Family Fairness Act, otherwise known as House Bill 2007. You have any members in your packets this morning a copy of the memo, which outlines that. The amendment also deletes the terms limited liability companies or trustee of a trust from the measure and also removes Section 1, Subsection AA from the original bill and adds new language which clarifies the specific classes of individuals that are exempted from real estate licensing law. We do have representatives from the bar and the real estate agency and the Oregon Association of Realtors to answer any questions.
Are there any questions on the amendment or the bill? We discussed this at length. Would anyone have any? Well, first of all, I would entertain a motion to move the dash one.
Dash fours, I believe, Mr. Chair.
I would appreciate. Pardon me?
I said dash fours.
Oh, dash fours. Representative Esquire.
Yes. Are we in a work session?
Yes, we are.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendments to be appended on House Bill. Let me see what the 2418.
Representative Esquire moves dash four amendments in House Bill 2418. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Would anyone like any clarification of the amendment from any of the experts that we have in the room?
Mr. Chair, I think that'd be a good idea.
I want to know. Susan, you want to?
Oh, thank you. Come on up, sir. Put you on the spot here.
Chair Shuffler, members of the committee, I'm Greg Nelson. I'm chair of the Real Estate Legislative Committee for the Real Estate and Land Use Section of the Oregon State Bar. And I'd be happy to explain the amendments. Our committee sponsored the bill. Originally, this was brought to our attention because the exclusions do include some property owners who sell their own property, but LLCs were not included, primarily because they didn't exist when the bill was originally passed. So our intention was to try to get LLC owners to be able to sell their own property without having to employ a realtor. In working on the bill, we found in working with the real estate agency that there were some technical things that we needed to address, and the amendment narrows down the scope of this so that it doesn't give broad ability for people, any member of an LLC, to sell their property. Only managing members We also found in the process that there were some minor things that could be clarified on corporations and partnerships, so that's what the amendment is for.
Any representatives?
I just wanted to make sure that we are not making a vehicle for individuals to sidestep the fact that they need to be licensed in the state of Oregon in order to interact in real estate without the benefit of a license, and I want to make sure that we do not allow that in this state.
And we agree with you on that. It's not our intention to open up non-licensed individuals to selling property. We're just looking for a level playing field for LLCs in relation to corporations and partnerships where they already can sell their own property without having to be licensed.
And I would like to, Mr. Chair, I would like to hear from Commissioner Bentley and from the Oregon Association of Realtors that they have no heart for it.
That, if you'd like to come on up, that'd be fine with me. Representative Holvey, wait a second, sir.
I just wanted to clarify. I mean, I think I see this here, that this basically allows LLCs to buy and sell property for themselves without being licensed?
As a
realtor?
Yes, that's true. It narrows it down more than that, though, because LLCs may be have many, many members, and only certain members can do that. So it doesn't open it up to 100 people to be able to buy and sell property under the guise of an LLC. Only the managing members who actively are involved in managing that LLC can do that.
So, so if I am understanding it, they're not selling property for other owners. They're just buying property as a business and then selling that property that they now own.
That's true. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
For clarification for Representative Holby, we can do that now as an individual. An individual can buy and sell as much property as they'd like within the state of Oregon without the benefit of a license. Corporations can, and in fact, you can, if you work for an individual and you're on a salary, you can work for that individual and manage property and things of this nature. So I think what this is a loose end out here, and we're tying that back in to make it to where it's pretty tidy group.
Okay, gentlemen, our friend from Medford Drug, you up here, what do you got to say about this?
Chair Schaffler, committee, I'm Gene Bentley, real estate commissioner. We've had an opportunity to look at this bill. As originally drafted, it was a little too wide for our concerns. I think the concerns that the committee has voiced were the same concerns that we had, that it would open it up to allow people to somehow sidestep being licensed. It has been narrowed now down to the point where it makes it on a parallel set of circumstances to limited liability companies are parallel with limited partnerships, where the managing member of a limited partnership has the opportunity to sell that property. In this particular case, it allows a sole member of an LLC, one person LLC, or the managing member of the LLC to provide those kinds of activities for the LLC.
Sean, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Sean Jillians, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'd echo what the commissioner just said. And Representative Holvey, to your point, I think the issue with the bill is more managing properties or selling properties that an LLC happens to own. I don't think it's necessarily that people are going to start forming LLCs just to do that particular activity, but it puts them on par with individuals and corporations for that purpose.
Any further questions? Representative Holby.
Well, thank you for that additional comment. So you're saying that this isn't going to allow LLCs to operate as a business to go out and buy and sell properties? I'm trying to make that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, individuals have that opportunity right now. We're certainly not prohibiting that, but we don't see this as a vehicle to open a huge hole for that sort of activity. That's all I was trying to make the point to you of.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Well, then I'd like to know how you would prevent that hole from being opened up, because it seems like I'm not objectionable to the concept, because the individuals have that right to do it.
but I'm just, I just question how you would stop that hole if it were to develop under this bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I think that would be an amendment if you wanted to stop that from, but as I stated previously, since individuals and corporations can already do this, we're simply putting them on par with that.
Further questions, Representative?
No, thank you. I was just trying to identify the hole and how the hole was contained.
And there may have been a monument of that hole in that hole one time. I'm sorry, I'm just having a little fun here. Any further questions of these fine gentlemen? All righty then. Thank you very much. All right, we have a motion before us. Is there any further discussion? Yes. Oh, we can't move the bill today.
We need the fiscal need amendments. So
we could adopt the amendments.
Yes, we can move the bill before, or we can just hold off and do another work session on Friday.
Let's just do
the motion. Isn't the motion to adopt the amendments?
Yeah,
right
we,
now?
Yeah,
let's
we can do that.
Let's do it all at once that day, please. So I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2814, and I'm going to open. Get my sheet out here. A public hearing on House Bill 2699.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2699 modifies the definition of public works. It requires prevailing wage rates be paid on public works projects for which public funds of an agency are used, including funds that are received in the form of a tax credit or tax abatement. The measure exempts projects that are privately owned and that use private funds and no more than a certain amount of funds from the public agency from prevailing wage requirements. There's an emergency clause on the measure effective upon passage. You have a number of amendments in front of you. You have a dash one and dash four amendments from Representative Polvey. The dash one modifies the threshold from a project exempted from prevailing wage rates law from $2,000 as proposed in the original bill to $50,000. The dash four amendment removes tax abatements from being included in the proposed new definition of funds for a public agency. You also have a dash two amendment, which is actually an amendment in the works. It's not, there's tweaks need to be taking place on this. The dash two replaces the bill and expands the definition of public works to include certain types of project located in an enterprise zone, consist of or sited on real property for which a qualified business has received a property tax exemption under the state's enterprise zone program and has a projected cost of at least $5 million. Then you also have a dash three amendment, which is last minute, I believe, from Representative Thatcher on this.
Teresa, just so people know, we're amending it with taking another bill and putting it in this.
Yes,
the
dash two.
What was the original bill?
Is the original bill was House Bill 2429.
Yeah, just so people know what's going on there.
Yep.
I believe Representative Holvey was his bill, so.
Oh, Representative Holvey, would you like to testify to this bill, please?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Thank you.
I'm glad you remembered it was my bill.
Yes, sir.
For the committee's indulgence on this, it's a shame that Representative Edwards was not here because he was the one that brought up the issue of a bright line in prevailing wage determinations and what projects were prevailing wage and which ones weren't. It's a... long frustrated me a little bit over the last 10 years to see the prevailing wage. By the way, I'm State Representative Paul Holvey for the record. To see the prevailing wage and public works contracts get into so much disarray and confusion about what the purpose of prevailing wage laws were and what projects should or should not be prevailing wage, and there seemed to be a lot of consternation over this subject over the years between public agencies and private individuals and people that work on these projects as well. So I asked Legislative Council to take a look at this issue and draft for me a bill that as closely as we could matches what the federal Davis-Bacon Act requires and defines as a public works project and prevailing wage, what generates or triggers the prevailing wage rate. And quite frankly, the original Davis-Bacon Act is actually quite simple and doesn't involve a lot of confusion about what is a public works project and what is not. It is simply, and the bill came back with a figure of if it has $2,000 of public funds in the project, it is considered a prevailing wage project. So that's what the Federal Davis-Bacon Act has set out. Pretty simple. Doesn't have a lot to do with whether the project is leased or owned by the public agency. It simply is. If there's $2,000 of public funds in it, then it triggers Davis-Bacon and prevailing wage rates. That's pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. It's a bright line that Representative Edwards really didn't want to talk about, and unfortunately he's not here. But that was how this bill got drafted. I asked the Legislative Council to come back with a bill that somewhat mirrored the Federal Davis-Bacon Act. After it came back, I recognized that $2,000 was sort of a pretty low figure, but so I amended it with the Dash 1 amendments to make it the $50,000, which is currently in the prevailing wage rates. But the bill does go through and eliminate a lot of the confusing part of the statutes that have appeared over the years and have steadily basically chipped away at what a prevailing wage job is, quite frankly. And so we have all these exemptions to what is a prevailing wage job, when in fact the Federal Davis-Bacon Act is very clear. It's the use of public funds that makes it a prevailing wage rate applicable job. And so I asked the Legislative Council for that kind of a draft. That's what I got. There is a Dash 4 that did not come back correctly. It was not supposed to eliminate the tax abatement. It was supposed to eliminate the tax credit. So I'm not in favor of the Dash 4 amendment, but I do like the Dash 1 moving it from $2,000 to $50,000. And I know this bill has generated a lot of interest from a lot of folks who see a lot of huge implications to this bill, and I acknowledge that there are a lot of implications to this bill, but it always kind of flabbergasted me that we spend so much time in court trying to figure out how not to pay prevailing wages, which are why if we're using public dollars, would we want to pay less than the county average wage for construction workers? Baffles me to no end. It seems to me that the policy of the state should more closely mirror our federal government statutes on this issue. Seems to me to be good public policy that we not have public contracts or using public funds to basically lowball the average wage in our counties, that it makes good economic sense that people that work for a living can make a decent living and have money to spend in our economy. And so I brought this bill forward out of frustration on this issue, year after year of listening to people saying, if we have to pay prevailing wages, this is going to kill our project. You know, if we have to pay prevailing wages, we're not going to do it. Well, frankly, if you don't want to pay prevailing wages, don't use public funds. That's why I brought this bill forward. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chair and committee.
You know, Mr. Representative, I couldn't agree with everything you just said more. Now, who buys all these houses and cars, trucks? Who goes out to eat in our restaurants and our taverns? Who spends their money? I tell you, it ain't people that don't have any money. It's people that have a job and can afford it. Who sends their kids to college? It's people that have a job and can afford it, not those that don't have it. And you're exactly right. You know what? And the reason we're using this vehicle for another bill is because we compromise in this building. We know that hard ideology may not win the day all the time. But I couldn't agree with everything you just said more. I think someday we should make it $2,000. Any kind of if public money even looks at it, I don't care. Abatement, credit, land, cash, I don't care. it should be $2,000. Now, I'm probably not going to get my way on that, but you know what? I couldn't agree with you more. And just say, that's it. And if you don't want to, if you don't want to pay prevailing wage, then go round up the financing privately. And God bless you and more power to you. But I couldn't agree more. And the problem with this country is we're not doing enough to create those family wage jobs, which includes development of water, felling more timber, more flexible land use for industry and manufacturing, and a tax code that goes along with it to attract and retain that investment and create and retain these family wage jobs. But you're exactly right, and I could not agree more. And I just want to publicly apologize to you for using this as a vehicle for a compromise bill. A compromise bill. We're going to have a compromise relating to prevailing wage bill.
Representative Kenemer.
Thank you. Representative Hulvey, and I don't have my folder here on 2420. If I remember correctly, that bill limited the issue to simply enterprise zones. And this expands it beyond enterprise zones. Is that correct? Your amendments? I haven't seen them until just now.
Which amendments are you talking about?
Well, your dash one and dash twos, right? Those are the ones that you support?
No, I have actually not reviewed the dash twos. Those are not my amendments. I submitted the dash one, which changed the figure from $2,000 to $50,000.
But that was not an issue addressed in 2420, the old bill.
These are separate concepts, first of all.
I'm speaking to the concepts in 2699, which is the bill that I'm presenting to the committee today. I'm not speaking on the dash twos or House Bill 2420. I don't think we're in that public hearing at the moment.
Well, but this also addresses enterprise zones.
We are hearing Representative Holley's bill, which I support and agree with. And we're going to use a relating clause for this, with this, your bill, Representative, as a vehicle to amend the enterprise zone prevailing wage bill. That's what's going on here. Just to clarify for everyone.
Thank you for that clarification, and I'll be watching that to see if I'm still going to be sponsoring this particular bill. But I'll be keeping an open mind as much as I can, and I appreciate you agreeing with me on this particular issue, because quite frankly, I've watched prevailing wages for 10 years and have continually watched the legislature chip away at those projects, saying that these are not prevailing wage projects, and so that enables people to come in with lower than county average wages and take public funds to build projects. That's contrary to the policy of the federal Davis-Bacon Act and what originally was the policy of the state.
Don't go anywhere, and I'm not sure what you're referring to as chip away. There may be, that may be open debate. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment that here in the very near future, with all the federal stimulus money that will be coming into our state and all the other states around the nation, we may be very grateful that we have a Davis-Bacon Act. A lot of money and a lot of opportunity for fly-by-night operations to come in and make a quick buck, perhaps not perform to standards that we would expect from our public contractors. And I think that this law in and of itself will be saving taxpayers' interest in terms of the standards for work performance that will be performed here in the Federal Stimulus Act. So,
thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Representative Hulvey. Just a quick question. Would this bill, I'm just thinking of state forest lands and public funds are used for purchasing of those lands and managing those lands, would this bring in state forest lands projects that are over $50,000 of harvesting timber, et cetera, for prevailing wage?
Only if they were building buildings on those federal, or building buildings on those, and that would be under the federal Davis-Bacon Act, I'm sure, but no.
So it's just construction of buildings.
Yeah, this is all about building buildings and structures, public works projects, I probably should say. And logging contracts on the federal Forest Service lands don't fall underneath ORS 279.
Okay, thank you.
That being said, I'd be willing to bet those good, hard-working American loggers are making a little more than whatever the prevailing wage is out on that rural area. Unfortunately, we don't have enough of them out there felling timber. Any further questions of the good representative here? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just might add that it's unfortunate we don't have a market for that timber right now either. So, thank you.
Well, we're importing logs, Representative, to keep our mills running. So, but that's another conversation, which I'd love to have. And just so folks know, a bunch of people signed up to testify on behalf or against or for House Bill 2699. Really, folks, today, we're not. You can testify if you like for or against that bill. We're using this bill as a vehicle for another bill. So if you're interested in testifying for, against, or neutral, which I've never understood neutral testimony, but if you're here to testify on relating to the Enterprise Zone prevailing wage bill, then I think you'd be interested in testifying. If you're here just to testify on this bill, well, we're not going to do this bill. So as I call you out, if you change your mind and don't want to testify in light of that information, I won't hold it against you for not testifying. I'm just going to write down the list. Oh,
Mr. Bob, I don't want to testify to the amendment. Did you ask him?
Yes.
Did he say yes?
Yes.
Oh, Mr. Shiprack, why don't you come on up here and let us know what's going on around here.
I'll try.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. What you have today is a gut and stuff. The relating clause on House Bill, what was it, the other bill, didn't fit. There was a drafting error made. It was caught by the Bureau of Labor and Industries. You should have some amendments, and I don't know if there are more coming or not, to fix and clarify the concept that I had in the original Enterprise Prevailing Wage Bill, which is the relating clause in Mr. Holvey's bill would work. I want to just remind the committee that the concept involved here is limited to projects of $5 million or more within enterprise zones in 2007. The last year we have complete data, this would have impacted 30 jobs across the state. These are large projects. The problem we're trying to solve here is that occasionally these projects attract out-of-state contractors and oftentimes out-of-state workers. At the same time, they're getting substantial public subsidies. The bill is limited to the tax abatement, but I must tell you, in the problem that we had in Albany with the Gatorade plant, for instance, there were public subsidies. The city acknowledged came to about $60 million on a $200 million project. So that's the issue we're trying to solve in these economic times. I just want to point out it's important that these jobs go to Oregon workers and employers. I feel pretty strongly about that. This bill will not guarantee it. But we do know that the Oregon prevailing wage law, when you look at the other projects around the state that utilize it, it seems to work really well in helping to ensure that Oregon contractors and workers perform the work. So that's just a reminder of what we're doing. It is a gut and stuff. The chair is correct. Ignore the first Bill 2699, and it'll be substituted with a whole new set of amendments, which I don't know if you've got or not. I have not seen them, and the committee administrator is saying you don't. So that's where we're at, as far as I know.
And we'll be ignoring that concept for now.
Correct.
There's always next session.
Correct.
Anyway.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ignoring what concept? I'm sorry.
The concept in the original bill, Representative.
Oh, I see.
We are not working
okay.
that concept.
Thank you.
We are working
the concept from the enterprise zone prevailing wage.
Correct.
So any questions of Mr. Shiprack while he's here? And we're not working the bill today because we don't have everything we need to send it out of here. Okay, well, thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
So if you changed your mind, if you're here on 2699, the original concept, I won't hold it against you if I call your name out. But if you want to testify to the concept relating to enterprise zones, prevailing wage, please come on up. And if I mispronounce your name, forgive me. I'm just going to go right down the line here. Representative Cameron, please.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think staff just handed in some written testimony of a member, not even a constituent of mine here in the local area, that needs to be passed out and was unable to testify. I just want to make note of that.
Great. Whenever Tamson gets it around, report that. Tim Gurley and Ken Dixon and Rick Thomas, please. If you're interested in the enterprise zone bill. After that, I got Ron Papstorp, Jack Eiselman, Scott Winkles. Then we'll follow up and end up with Doris Penwell. Go ahead, gentlemen, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim Gerling. I've spent the last 20 years building public works. I am going to testify on 2699, just for the record. I understand you're not working it today. Most recently, I am retired as the Public Works Director for the City of Salem. Currently, I'm the project manager for redevelopment of the Boise waterfront site here in downtown Salem. It is private funding, but we are in an urban renewal area. There will be public money invested in things that the city wants to see, foremost among those daylighting the creek, doing streetscape improvements, a public path that runs through the middle of our project, and a public street. We've worked for many months segregating the public projects from the private projects under the current law. The original bill as written and even the Dash 1 amendment will kill the project. That's $70 million of tax value that's not going to go on the tax rolls in the next couple of years. Conservatively, that's about $1.2 million a year of tax revenue for the Urban Renewal Agency to use as they see fit in other projects. Many of the jobs that we are proposing are going to pay prevailing wage anyway. It's things like heavy equipment operators, iron workers, electricians. The problem we run into is in the finishing trades. That adds at least 30% to the labor costs. That means no affordable housing for the mixed use that the city wants to see on that site. And in the current economy, the returns simply aren't there to proceed ahead with that. In closing, I would just say that public-private partnerships are crucial to get our economy moving again. It's one of the few tools that government has to leverage private investment into these projects, and I would urge a no vote. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Go ahead. Let's go first.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Ken Dixon. I'm a vice president of Todd Construction. We're an Oregon-grown general contractor since 1942. I'm a graduate of Oregon State University, and I've been with Todd for 10 years. And, you know, Todd Construction has performed a lot of projects over the last 67 years, both public and private. And, you know, with a little pride, I'd like to point out that east and west wings of this Capitol building, as well as the area we're occupying, were built by Todd Construction. Our recent largest public project is a $45 million high school, and private project, largest recent, is $32.5 million assisted living facility. But our bread and butter, really, are in the $5 to $10 million range for projects. And as a company, we attach a really high value to local hiring, both for employees and for subcontractors from Oregon and Southwest Washington here. And we do that because one of the real risk signs in construction is when a contractor starts working out of their normal geographic area. And there's already enough risk in construction. Obviously, we don't need any more. We also know it's really smart to take care of the people that take care of you. And for instance, of our 56 employees, 9 of those have between 20 and 40 years of service with our company. 6 of them are second generation. 1 is a third generation. So we understand what it is to really take care of people. And in preparation for speaking with you today, I just went back to our last 2 years of operations, and I compiled some data which has been distributed. And as you can see, of the 19 projects that account for about $136.5 million total contract volume, 218 of the 223 subcontractors were local. On the private and on the public, 219 of the 231 subcontractors were local. The dollars really follow right along with that. And although this is only 2 years' data, I can just tell you that the numbers really don't change much from project to project or from year to year. So in summary, I guess what I'm saying is I don't see any empirical evidence that prevailing wages are going to positively affect local hiring in any way. In fact, to me, that really kind of flies in the face of business sense that tells me that non-local contractors, when they're working out of town, they're going to have a higher base labor cost overall, and local contractors are going to have a lower one. That's what gives them their competitive advantage. But as more projects become subject to prevailing wages, what you see is these local contractors, their wage rates are going to increase, and suddenly non-local contractors, their higher uneconomically viable wage rates become viable, and they're able to come in, they're able to take projects away from Oregon contractors. An example of this, for instance, is South Medford High School. It's a $64 million project, and the contractor of choice is it's a contractor out of Utah. And I just wonder if anybody really believes that if that project were, say, an office building, or if it were an assisted living facility that was competitively bid using non-prevailing wage rates, would they be able to come into Oregon and take that job? I don't really think so. So, you know, it seems to me, when speaking of enterprise zones, based on what I read in 1985, when the legislature first enacted the enterprise zone legislation, the intents were to attract private business investment and to help resident businesses grow and invest. Now, that's the same thing that Todd Construction has done to grow, so we really resonate with what those intents are. But I would urge a no vote on this bill because I do not believe, I don't see how it can happen, that by subsidizing and encouraging out-of-state or non-local contractors that you can encourage development in enterprise zones. So I really appreciate the opportunity to come here and speak with you today.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Morning, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Thomas. I'm here this morning with Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. We oppose House Bill 2699 in the fashion, I guess, it's intended to be amended. We support the idea of local hire of contractors, obviously representing many local contractors throughout the state, but we do not see a connection between prevailing wage requirements and the hiring of local contractors, much for some of the reasons that Mr. Dixon articulated, and you know, the South Medford High School project, a $62 million public works project that has a Utah contractor, we think is a fairly good example of our concerns there. We have let the proponents of the legislation know that you know, we support the idea of, you know, contractors local being hired, and we'd be more than willing to work with them on some ideas to do that. So far, we haven't been taken up on that offer, but we, you know, again, would entertain the idea of, you know, doing something to encourage the local hire of contractors. If that's the goal, and local hire is the goal, then we attack that issue rather than trying to expand prevailing wage in private projects. So for those reasons, we oppose 2699 in the fashion that it sounds like it's going to be amended.
Just to get it out here again, the whole point of prevailing wage was to avoid someone from dragging a crew from a lower wage area into a place where the prevailing wage, the area wages were, and putting them to work, because then they'd have to drag them up here, pay the local wages and their housing, because no one in their right mind would go somewhere and work and not have all that stuff paid for, because it wouldn't have been worth it. I'm not articulating it very well, I freely admit. But there's a couple things that were said here that I really have to take issue with. And by the way, I do support the $2,000 level, and there's states in the country right now that do have that. If Representative Holvey, if I'm not wrong, he's not listening to me.
every word, I'm on the edge of my seat.
You know, the point is, you said that project would be dead over here, sir. Well, now, these other states that have far stricter standards and a far lower bar to get over, the trigger is far less to prevail in other states. And if I listen to your logic,
then they wouldn't have any of these projects going on in their states. Well, I just think that's simply factually not true. And matter of fact, I don't think, and to use your words, there's no empirical evidence to prove that that's true. The Davis-Bacon was established so that workers in the area wouldn't lose their jobs to out-of-state workers or out-of-area workers for a less amount, therefore helping the community thrive. So I just had to take issue on that. If you want to respond, go ahead. If you don't, that's fine with me. And I'll open it up to questions of these fine gentlemen. Would you like to respond to what
I
said?
If I may respond, sir.
Thank you very much.
You just said what I said was not factually true, and I'd like to defend that.
That's fine.
All projects are conceived under the laws in effect and the economy in effect at the time the project budgets are put together. This particular project was put together using current state law. It's going to be very complicated because of the public projects that are going to go through the middle of the private one. So we've worked very hard to try and segregate them so that there's no question which are public projects and we will clearly pay prevailing wage on those and which portions are not. If the rules change in the middle, that basically causes the project to go back to the drawing board, and it will effectively kill it for at least 2 years while we figure out what we're doing. That was the basis of my statement.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Questions of these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Matthews, then Holy.
I guess I have a comment about some of what was said, and I guess when I look at the enterprise zones and how they function to local governments, right now everybody's struggling. I can't think of a local government right now that can afford to give tax abatements for a three-year period or whatever it turns out to be. With that being said, if they were to offer that, then what are they going to get in return? Obviously, Todd Construction is doing well, and congratulations. Sounds like you're operating a great business, and I can appreciate that. But my point is, I think our citizens are actually tired of having our governments just give tax abatements and getting nothing in return. And what we're asking for is hire local people first. Now, I appreciate what you said, but how do you get there? And so we're working on that, and that's what we're struggling, and this prevailing wage is one of those things that we feel is going to get us there, but we're having discussions with a lot of folks. So my only point is that if we're going to continue to offer tax abatements to attract private business in, first of all, what happens when it doesn't pan out and they're gone in 2 years or 3 years? They didn't create the jobs in the economy. You've got a building that's just single-dimensional. It works for one thing only, and now you're stuck because that land's been used. And so there's a lot to think about besides just saying, well, this will kill the job. Because quite honestly, our people are getting tired of just giving for folks to attract out-of-state people to build. And if they're going to build from out-of-state, welcome to Oregon, but use our own labor force. It's not organized labor, it's Oregon labor. There's a big difference in that.
First.
I guess I'm not saying that anything is going to get killed or anything like that. And personally, I'm not a big fan of tax abatements or anything like that. I think that projects ought to be able to go on their own. I guess all I'm saying is that from my understanding of enterprise zones, they're often going to be maybe more of a rural area. They're not going to be in a major metropolitan area. And the way that prevailing wages are calculated, they're going to, in essence, overweight those metropolitan areas. So, you know, Representative Holvey, you used the word average several times, and average is a mathematical word that concept does not work for prevailing wages. That's not how they're calculated. It's based on the number of hours that are reported on the wage surveys, and if a simple majority, if there's 100 hours reported, and 51 of those hours are at a single wage rate, as in maybe a collective bargaining agreement or whatever that may be, then they all revert to that wage rate. And so where you have this thing where if the metropolitan area is heavily weighting those, then a majority of the hours could easily become prevailing wage. And so it's not really an average. It's not the wages prevailing in that area. It's the wages prevailing in the metropolitan area. Enterprise zone's probably not located there. You just haven't done it. Not to mention the fact, my numbers are going to show you that we're already doing the job of local hiring. It's being done. There doesn't need to be any additional things. If you're at 95% to 98%, and just as a matter of full disclosure, you see that I don't have 100% local subcontractors on there, although our employees are 100% local. Subcontractors are not. Well, there are certain skills such as elevator manufacturing installation that we just don't have in abundance in this local market, so we're going to have to get Otis Elevator out of Chicago or somebody like that for a multi-story building.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Again, Rick Thomas, Chairman Schaffler, Representative Matthews. I think going back to the issue of local contractor hiring and, you know, just trying to be creative with some ideas, I think one possible option, just thinking off the cuff, would be having a discussion about, you know, setting some sort of benchmark for hiring of local contractors on these projects, and if the project owner is able to hit some sort of a target, they get 100% of their tax abatement, but graduating it if we start to drop to low levels of local hire. Again, that's going to attack the issue of local hiring and ensuring that there's, you know, local contractors attached to these projects.
I think the benchmark for local hiring may have some serious legal and constitutional questions. So, Representative Holby, then Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you, gentlemen, and I respect your opinions and your notions that you presented here today. I just respectfully disagree with a few of them, obviously. You know, and this whole notion of local hire is an important one, but really prevailing wage rates are set to help protect local hire so that you can't have contractors coming in from the outside with low ball figures, because they can bring a very low wage workforce from out of the area and undermine your projects. And so, you know, and the comments that you make that prevailing wages you know, don't have a positive effect on local hiring, what they do have is have a positive effect on maintaining the community's area standards for those wages, to prevent the outside people from coming in. And to say that prevailing wages decrease the competitive edge of local contractors basically says that the way you're competing is by using lower wages. And so, you know, I just want to state something real briefly. The 279C850 in the state of Oregon, this is public policy for the state of Oregon, that the purpose of prevailing wage rate law are to ensure that contractors compete on their ability to perform work competently and efficiently while maintaining community-established compensation standards. So that's why, and that's why prevailing wages exist, is to help protect our community's wage standards, so that you know, we can all afford to live in our own communities. And so, you know, to use wages as your ability to have a competitive edge, and use those wages, and, you know, because you're, you know, I would argue that the definition of local is perhaps also a little bit subjective. But, you know, quite frankly, if somebody comes in from Portland and down to Salem and they're paying the community wages here, you know, they have every right to bid work here. And the prevailing wage rates help protect this community's area standards from that Portland contractor coming down with a lower wage level, or, you know, wherever they come from. So I just think the whole notion of local hire being the mantra, it misses the point of why is local hire important. It really is the purpose of the prevailing wage laws to protect those wage levels and those compensation standards, and, you know, to encourage health care and to encourage apprenticeship and training. Those are all parts of the public policy of the state of Oregon. And so anyway, that's...
I really have to pile on there, too. Not only the wages, but our level of apprenticeship and quality level of journeymen and who we turn out, especially the private union apprenticeship programs, far exceeds many states in this country. So you hire the locally apprenticed and turned out journeyman in Oregon, you're getting a higher skilled worker who's going to provide a lot higher quality of product. So there's a lot more than just the wages going on here. But oh, please respond, gentlemen, if you wish.
You know, just one last comment, and I think we all, you know, agree that prevailing wage is setting a local standard for the wage that's perceived to be the local wage standard for that area. You know, the only thing concern about this bill, I guess, and that maybe we're not articulating, is that it just ensures that people working in those areas are paying what that perceived industry standard wage is, not that those folks are local contractors.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to comment that I very much resent the inference that those of us who live in rural areas ought to somehow have earned the right to earn less in wages. Our food costs cost more. Our transportation costs cost more. Our heating costs are more. In fact, these gentlemen could pick a market basket of goods anywhere in metropolitan I-5 corridor, pick that market basket of goods, price it. I'll purchase the same goods in rural Oregon, and I'll tell them that it will cost a heck of a lot more. And the mentality that suggests that we should earn less in rural Oregon is the same mentality that drives wages down by cutting prevailing wage rate. This is not anything that garners my sympathy, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Enterprise zones.
Yes, sir.
Why did we create them? I'll tell you why we created them, because we're competing with South Carolina, Alabama, Texas, the Midwest, and a lot of those people give them the property tax-free. That's what we're competing with. And it's a matter of competition. If we go about what we're planning to do, and by the way, my community has more enterprise zones and e-commerce overlays than any other community in the state of Oregon. You're virtually going to hamstring my community. Period. Economic development, both Southern Oregon Regional Economic Development and the City of Medford Economic Development have come out and stated this. So I will not support this. If we want to give an advantage to a local worker, let's do it. Myself and Representative Klim have a bill in that would allow people locally to have a 7.5, and you have to live within the community and have your bricks and mortars, your headquarters within the county, a 7.5% leeway on advantage on the bid. If you live within the state, you have a 5%. If you live within the United States, you have a 2.5%. If you're not from the United States, you have nothing. That gives an advantage to a local worker. Problem is, there may be some laws involved.
And you know,
we can't do it.
First of all, I know somebody who ain't running for president anytime soon. But on that, I would be willing to bet that if we knew everything, it's not our wage and hour policies in the state compared to those other states. It's our land use policies in the state. The rigid, inflexible land use policies in this state send large investors to those states that my good friend just rattled off, and it has way more to do with that than hiring good quality workers at a good quality wage to give you a good quality product. You gentlemen want to respond to any of that, and then
can
I'm
I
going
finish?
To represent Cameron, and then we're moving on.
Well, I can't finish.
Oh, would you like to follow up, Representative? we need to move on to. We're beating this to death.
The last thing is the South Medford project was done by an out-of-state bidder, and it wasn't a $62 million project. It was an $84 million project. And all that money is going out of state. That was a prevailing wage job.
Do you guys want to just... I'm just going to move on to represent Cameron and then represent Thatcher, and I'll give you guys a chance to
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to go back to what my understanding the original purpose of prevailing wage was. And maybe somebody can help clarify that for me, that, and especially being a public works director, it's my understanding that prevailing wage was set in place to protect the constituents that I represent, not necessarily the people who are working on the job. As government goes into building a building or building a road, they have to take the lowest cost with the lowest bid, and when you put a prevailing wage in there, that takes out the ability for somebody to do shabby work or bring in low-cost people and drive that project down based on labor alone. So it puts quality to protect the citizens that I represent, and I want to make sure that that's one issue.
that I understand that correctly?
That is also my understanding, sir. You're absolutely correct. Working for a public agency, this state and most others, I believe, the public agency is required by law to take the lowest responsive bidder.
Okay, thank you.
Whether they're any good or not,
that's a problem. Now, the people who would be doing these contracts in enterprise zones are private. Are private owners, and their investment is not something that they have to protect my constituents from shoddy work. It's their own investment that they're going to hold long term or sell or do what have you. So it's in two different scenarios here. They can take the lowest cost bidder if they, they will. They don't have to take the lowest cost bidder. They can focus on other issues such as quality and other things that may be in that contract that they're looking at, different than a public works contract. Is that accurate?
That is correct, sir. In my particular case, we're not in an enterprise zone. We're not receiving any tax abatements or tax credits. But you're absolutely right. One of the things that I'm really enjoying working for the private sector after so many years in government is the ability to negotiate for quality work rather than be ruled simply by what's the lowest cost. We can look at performance, we can look at quality, we can look at time of delivery, those sort of things. What the private investor is protecting basically is the return on investment. And the way that you get in trouble quicker than anything is build something that's shoddy. It's going to cost you way more in the long run. So that is one of the things that I'm truly enjoying since I retired.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for helping me understand that. Last thing I want to just comment on the fact that there's today, the last figure I have was 236,000 unemployed Oregonians. It's probably higher than that. That we need to be very careful if we hear testimony to passing legislation that's going to defer projects for 2 years, putting people to work at any level of wage. Mr. Chair, I have a real problem with supporting any kind of legislation that's going to slow down putting anybody back to work or possibly laying some people off who are lined up to do a job.
Oh, I appreciate that sentiment. I believe it's lowest responsible bidder, isn't it? It's responsible, not responsive. Correct. I just wanted to clarify that. And the criteria for who's responsible includes quality of work, history, and in my opinion, since we're using my tax dollars, wage and hour and working conditions and benefits, because whose money are we talking about here? We're talking about my money and their money, and it's just one of the conditions I think, in my humble opinion, should be applied to who's responsible and who isn't. Now there's obviously room for argument on that. Representative Thatcher, and then we're going to move on and let these guys follow up on whatever they have to say before we go. Representative.
Thank you, and I don't know if it's more a question or comment that I'm asking you to comment on, but of course we're hearing about a lot of job losses lately. We're cutting jobs left and right. You hear about companies laying off workers, and you also hear about people getting their hours cut or their pay cut. If they're still lucky enough to be earning a paycheck, the bottom line there would be that they would be getting less in their paycheck. And I'm wondering, I was just looking at just an example of wages in Lake County. I picked Lake County. That's pretty high unemployment, 17.5% right now, last figures that came out. And in January of 2008, the prevailing wage rate for a carpenter was $29.22. That's the base rate, as I understand it. And it went up more than a couple dollars a year later. And it just seems like, to me, what they're called prevailing wage, it just seems like that, those numbers keep going up for prevailing wage. I don't see them ever go down. And I just see that in this economy, in most businesses not having to be subjected to this particular law, that you do see reductions. And maybe just a comment, what if you've seen any of that in your particular industry or...
Well, obviously, we have heard a lot of layoffs. We haven't been in that position at this point, but Yeah, working with prevailing wages, I can tell you they go up a fair amount on a regular basis, just as you've seen. You know, in our case, we pay well enough that that doesn't affect us too much, but I know that there are many cases where that really can make a difference. We're just finishing an assisted living facility right now where, because times are tough, we kind of poked our nose into the owner's financing arrangements to make sure we were going to be able to get paid and that project was going to get done. And, you know, it absolutely would not have happened were it in an enterprise zone where the prevailing wages would have taken place. I do know that all of our carpenters certainly made a reasonable living on it. But we pay full family medical. You know, we pay a 6% match dollar for dollar into the 401k. We great benefits, but at the same time, I know that that project would not have made it. And we were having 200 workers a day on that project for the last year.
I just can't help commenting before I let you guys go. Our economic downturn and problems are not a result of prevailing wage in Oregon. That's all there is to it. It's way, way bigger than that. And it's way beyond and above our pay scale. Incredible irresponsibility, 3,000 miles from here, and God knows where else. You guys have anything else you want to follow? I really appreciate you coming. I like the conversation, and I'm sure it's going to continue.
Thank
All right, Ron Papsdorf, Jack Eisenman, Scott Winkles. Go. Oh, excuse me. Scott, just stay where you are. Ron, Jack, and Tom Hughes. And we'll follow up with Scott and Doris. Sit down, guys. If it's already been said, don't say it. Welcome to the committee.
I'll go. Morning, Chair Schaffler, committee members. For the record, Ron Papsdorf for the City of Gresham, here opposing both the original bill, House Bill 2699, as well as the -2 amendments and other variants thereof. Gresham is a city of 100,000 people in the Portland metropolitan area, the fourth largest city in the state. I want to give a little bit of background to the committee, if you'll indulge me, on the Gresham Enterprise Zone, what it has done. I will be brief, Chair.
Ron, before you get going, this is an enterprise zone, not a, what is it? What's the other level of investment?
Mr. Chair, we have a strategic investment zone in Gresham as well.
And you're not referring to that now?
That's correct, and the -2 amendments, my understanding, Mr. Chair, don't apply to that particular component.
Thank you very much.
The Gresham Enterprise Zone was enacted in 2006. So far, we've had three companies take advantage of the Enterprise Zone benefit with a total investment value so far for those three companies of $52 million. And the creation of 200 new permanent jobs in the city of Gresham. Gresham historically has been a bedroom community to Portland, exporting employees to jobs elsewhere in the region, so it's been a very important goal of our city and our city council to attract new job creation within the community. It's our belief that many of these types of investments don't happen but for the presence of that enterprise zone. As an example, Boeing and R.R. Donnelly are two of the three companies that have qualified for the enterprise zone benefit in our enterprise zone. They were competing not only within their company nationally, but in Boeing's case, internationally with other Boeing units as well as other Boeing vendors. The enterprise zone was a deciding factor, one of the deciding factors to help the corporations make the decision to make those investments at their facilities in Gresham rather than other facilities within their business unit nationally or internationally. It's also important to note that out of that $52 million total value of investment, less than $2 million is construction value. The remaining $50 million is equipment only. That's new equipment investment in those plants. And yet, the -2 amendments are written with a $5 million threshold for enterprise zone investments that would count the value of that equipment. We think that that's inappropriate, and if the idea is tying prevailing wage to enterprise zone investments and that prevailing wage applies to those construction jobs, it ought to be limited to the value of the actual construction associated with those investments. The value of these projects to Gresham can't be overstated. New good-paying jobs are very important to our community, as well as increased property value that's created through these investments. These are short-term targeted property tax abatements with long-term property tax increase benefits to the community that help us pay for our critical police and fire services, and we are under extreme budget constraints now. So we believe that in most cases these investments would not happen in our community but for the enterprise zone benefit, for the size and the scale of these investments, and that the long-term benefits to the community far outweighs the short-term value of those property tax abatements. We'll finish up with a couple of quick points, Mr. Chair. The existing enterprise zone statute currently requires a first source hiring agreement for these companies for the permanent jobs, and that means that the new jobs created by these investments have to be offered first to local employees. We fully support that. The city also supports one of the intents of this idea to actually extend that to local construction jobs and make sure that local labor is utilized as much as possible. In terms of maximizing the benefits of these investments to the local community, Gresham has elected to apply additional criteria as part of our enterprise zone, including the adoption of a local procurement plan for local purchasing by these companies, that 75% of the employees must be paid at least twice the minimum wage, and that the employer must provide benefits that at least equal the national average. As an example of the procurement impact...
Mr. Pastor, I'm going to have to interject here. I want to hear what you have to say relating prevailing wage and enterprise zones. That's what we're talking about today. I don't need all this history. So let's tighten it up. I want to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I will end with, in 2008, Boeing under our requirement for local procurement had $15 million worth of local procurement. A million of that was spent with 14 local companies that hadn't previously been Boeing vendors. It's those kinds of benefits from Enterprise Zone that we think could be at risk by introducing something that is unusual, unfamiliar with these private companies. Construction contractors know how to deal with prevailing wage on public works projects. These private companies that are building factories, installing new equipment, don't understand prevailing wage. It's a new and unusual thing for them. And I don't know, and I can't tell you whether or not that would make some of these investments, make these companies make different decisions or not, but we're concerned about the uncertainty created, and we're concerned about the blunt force tool that prevailing wage application to these private projects might have on the success of our enterprise zone programs and other tax abatement programs. We think that a better approach would be applying the first source hiring agreement to the construction jobs just as we do to the permanent jobs. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, Jack Hesselman, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. Just let me say at the outset, I flew back from Disneyland to be before the committee today, and my appearance here, I think, is going to be more intense than Space Mountain was. So
this is the happiest place on Earth.
Thank you. That's very relevant to what we're discussing, Mr. Hesselman.
There's a lot of energy, obviously, on the committee today. And
Every day.
And I want to make a quick observation that the chair made and concur with you on land use and industrial lands. People fight fundamentally, I think, for two reasons. Either the stakes are so large that there's no option to fight. The Civil War is an example of that. Or the stakes are so small, you're fighting for survival. I think in the context of this bill, we may be having the latter kind of fight rather than the former, and that's regrettable, and I think that's largely a byproduct of our industrial lands paucity throughout the state. We need to address that problem. If we had more projects, I submit to you, we wouldn't be having this fight today. So don't consider this bill in a vacuum, but we're here today on this bill, and I'll speak to it. The Oregon Economic Development Association represents over 200 members who are involved in economic development throughout the state and are on the front line doing the intake on business retention and recruitment. We agree with you on the goal. We agree that every project that benefits from an Oregon Economic Development Incentive should employ the maximum number of Oregonians from the beginning of construction through the end of the project. We also agree that those projects should pay a family wage from inception through duration of the project. I think we may disagree on the means on how to get there. We submit to you one of the best ways to ensure that a local workforce will be present and working on the project is to maintain local control. If the zone sponsors, the cities, the counties, and the ports, most of whom are elected or appointed officials, by elected officials, are required to institute these zones and monitor them, we submit to you that the voters have a more direct line of recourse to them if they employ out-of-state workers or if they invite projects in that pay substandard wages. We think that check at the local government level is perhaps the most effective way to administer this problem. And we fear that a change in kind of a statewide preemption that the Dash 2 amendments might propose could inhibit that type of local control. I have with me today Tom Hughes, a colleague of mine, immediate past mayor of Hillsborough. He can speak to you briefly about his experience as a mayor. They created an enterprise zone up in Hillsborough, put in some local provisions around procurement, and is available. We're all available to answer your questions.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Hughes, and I work for Tonkin Torp, and I'm here today representing the OEDA. Relating back to what Jack just said about our experience in Hillsborough a little bit, we created an enterprise zone. We have 9 companies that have applied for enterprise zone, and of those, I think we've probably attracted about $500 million in investment, created probably 700 construction jobs, and close to 1,500 ongoing permanent jobs. I can't tell you sitting here today that all of those companies paid prevailing wage in their construction jobs. My guess is they did, given the nature of their construction, but I don't know because I'm not privy to that information. My guess is the companies don't know whether they did or not, and that's one of the concerns we have about prevailing wage as the tool to get at what I think we all agree is a desirable outcome. I would agree, as Jack did, with Chair Schaffer, that a good deal of the problem the state of Oregon has to do with our land use policy. And because of our land use policy, site selectors, who are the professionals that look for sites around the country to locate companies, to locate projects, quite frequently leave Oregon off their list because we are on a list of states that are viewed, because of our land use laws, as not friendly to business. The problem with prevailing wage in some respects has more to do with its perception than its application. The perception of prevailing wage around the country is that it's not business friendly and that it adds an enormous additional cost. My concern is that if you add prevailing wage to one of our incentive programs that we currently have to offer, that site selectors will see that as yet another unbusiness friendly act by the state of Oregon, and they will remove us from other lists for other projects. So we'll lose projects that we don't even know exist. I would also correct a perception, I think, that Chair Schaffer, that you had, there are lots of states that do this. Currently, according to the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department research, there are really only 3 states that have any kind of prevailing wage on private projects. One of those is New York, which actually has a requirement that is very similar to what we're saying, and that they allow their local governments to impose some kind of prevailing wage or some kind of local hire agreement within their what is the same as their enterprise zone. Their 2 states are Minnesota and New Jersey, and quite frankly, in 8 years of doing economic development with the city of Hillsborough, I don't think we ever were in competition for a project with either New Jersey or Minnesota. So the states that we are most in competition with don't have this provision, and therefore it would act again as a small, perhaps, but I think a very finite disincentive for companies that were comparing us to Texas or New Mexico or Arizona, for example, which is our major competitors. within the enterprise zone, within the operation of the enterprise zone, the difficulty for the companies that would look at encumbering this responsibility is that it carries with it a legal liability that extends into the future. So if you were planning on locating a company at a site in an enterprise zone today, or with the prevailing wage that is considered in the Dash 2 amendments, you would acquire a legal liability that your contractor had paid prevailing wage when you may not have any direct control over that. And that legal liability extends for 6 years after the completion of the project. So 6 years from the completion of your factory, a worker on that project can come to the Commissioner of Labor and allege that they were underpaid according to prevailing wage laws, and you could be subject, along with the contractor and the local sponsor, which would be the city or port, for back pay plus interest plus fines. And it's that legal uncertainty that makes that makes prevailing wage a disincentive for companies that would like to locate. These companies all are paying top dollar for their construction. You don't build a 20,000 square foot chamber that's going to contain product at liquid nitrogen temperatures and bring in Billy Bob from South Carolina to do the plumbing for you. I mean, you're going to hire top-notch construction workers to do that. The disincentive is the additional liability and uncertainty that it creates, and quite frankly, that is enough for them perhaps to say enterprise zone is not useful, therefore we'll look at the other states that had offered other opportunities. And I think it is the collective wisdom of the professionals, economic development professionals of the state, that that this bill with the Dash 2 amendments will mean fewer jobs for the state of Oregon, fewer construction jobs, as well as fewer ongoing jobs, and that's why we oppose it. Thank you.
And I guess people can disagree, right?
And we have.
And I think Hillsboro and Gresham have done a fine job of economic development. I just want to get that on the record. As far as the disincentive goes, then you wouldn't have any federal contractors doing any federal work because there would be disincentive of whether they reported the hour wage or not. I'm not done, Mr. Mayor.
Yep.
And for the life of me, and I've struggled with this since I've been a legislator, even when I was a city councilor as well, I just don't understand why local governments wouldn't want their workers to make a prevailing wage and then spend money at the very businesses that you all are doing such a great job of bringing in and helping build the community. For the life of me, that's just an editorial comment, but I want to open up the questions to these gentlemen. Any questions of these good gentlemen, and I'll let you follow up and respond and rebut and all that good stuff. Well, okay, I think we've beat this to death. Go ahead and respond to my comments.
Mr. Chairman,
please.
If I could, please, just a quick response. I think that the difference between what is proposed in this bill and Davis-Bacon is that Davis-Bacon applies to everybody. So we may lose out competition with other countries that don't have prevailing wage, but we don't lose out to other states on federal jobs. The difficulty with this particular proposal is we would be unique, and it's the uniqueness that creates the disincentive.
It's our unique land use system that is really the biggest disincentive. And what after this, I want after out in the hall, I want to know what you guys are doing about it after this hearing.
Mr.
Ron,
Chair, just
one more comment, and then we're moving on.
Vesquel has a question, but I want to just follow up a little bit on Mr. Hughes' comment on Davis-Bacon, because I think there's also a little bit of a misunderstanding about the application of Davis-Bacon nationally. I think the national application of that is an important point, but it's also my understanding that Davis-Bacon applies to projects that have $2,000 or more of federal funds in the project, making it a public work subject to Davis-Bacon. The Dash 2 amendments applying state prevailing wage to enterprise zone private projects goes well beyond that and extends it not to $2,000 or $50,000 or $750,000 or $5 million of local money going into the project. It's tax abatement definition. Davis-Bacon does not consider tax abatements, tax credits, and those things. It would be like saying that a homeowner in Oregon that installed a new energy efficient hot water heater and got
a $1,500 state energy tax credit, had to pay prevailing, go through the prevailing wage project process and pay prevailing wage to their contractor to install that hot water heater.
Thank you. And before you go, guys, I want to help you and the League of Oregon Cities and Association of Counties help you get some flexibility and some common sense into this land use system we have. That's what you know what? Let's get together where we agree and do something about it, and then we won't have to. And I'm moving on, guys. Okay, thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it. I know, I see. Representative Esquivel, go ahead.
Second time.
I'm not making you guys jump here, up and down on purpose,
and
I promise.
And the chair is precisely correct. And I think former Governor Attia summed it up in our land use hearing. He said he worked on the first committee for Senate Bill 100, and he said we created land conservation and development. He said the unfortunate thing is that they've emphasized conservation and no development. And I think he was dead on. As long as we allow people to take care of our land use in a vacuum in Salem, and one size fits all, we will have a problem. I have had businesses come to my community and said, we're coming here in spite of your land use, in spite of you. That's saying it all.
And I think the good people that support this bill, in all likelihood, would support some kind of common sense and flexibility in our land use so we could promote more development projects for family wage jobs in this state that generate incredible amounts of revenue that do all the things that we want to do in this state. Okay, guys, thank you very much. We beat it to death, which is what our job is, I guess. Scott Winkles and Doris Penwell. And anyone else want to testify to this today? Come on up. We won't bite you. They won't put a muzzle on me. Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doris Penwell. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, and very respectfully, we have to say that the concept of the Dash 2 amendments in this bill are something that the association cannot support, based on the fact that it is a statewide mandate on an otherwise local option proposition, which enterprise zones are. There are other details that also matter, but and one of them is the overlay of all the bully administrative things onto a otherwise private investment. There isn't a local official that doesn't want to hire the local workers, either in the construction or in the investment in the enterprise zone itself. And as other people have stated to you, the enterprise zones were created for long-term permanent jobs, and that was a concept in 1985 when this was proposed. In rural areas of the state, particularly, this is you create an enterprise zone because you want to move investment towards something where you really need the investment. It's not such a case in the urban enterprise zones that we do have, although the urban enterprise zones are located in an area where you might not otherwise invest. In the local enterprise zone operation, there are always ways of adding conditions to both the construction as well as the operation of the facilities that are coming permanently. And I really do want to support what some of the other folks that have testified to is if the concern is hiring local workers at good paying jobs, we should do some sort of a first source hiring agreement for them as well as in the same way we do it for the permanent jobs, for the permanent investments that are being made. And I don't think I need to repeat what everybody else has said on this in this testimony,
but if
you have any questions, thank you.
Scott, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I assure you, Mr. Chairman, as my prepared remarks are now irrelevant, I will be brief.
But never irrelevant, Mr. Winkles.
Well,
not in the eyes of this committee.
Thank you, sir. I only meant the changes, not that. At any rate, I would respectfully submit to the committee that what we have is a disagreement not on the fundamental objective of the legislation, but on the route to get there. The concern the League of Oregon Cities has with this, with the Dash 2 amendments, is that when it's local community attracting a business, it's much like a job interview, or a business has put out a job posting, and you get a lot of resumes and a lot of applications. And on that first screen, what you're looking for is you're looking for reasons to pull people out of the pool. And the concern the League of Oregon Cities has is that with the Dash 2 amendments is that we now have a, for good, bad, or indifferent, a business is going to look at that prevailing wage requirement and pull a community out of the pool. What we think is appropriate is that give the local jurisdictions have the authority to do things like first source hiring, like local procurement practices, like requirements for family wages. That, I think, is that doesn't expose the business or the local government to any legal liabilities 6 years down the road after the project is completed. And you've already heard from the committee all the great things that have happened in Oregon as a result of the existing E-Zone projects in Hillsborough and in Gresham, and there are many places, many other examples that we could cite. But I would just urge you, in this, particularly in this time where Oregonians have, we're in double-digit unemployment, that we proceed very cautiously as we address this tool that has been so successful in bringing jobs to the state.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes, please.
May I add one other comment before I leave? I would be remiss if I didn't. Over the last 4 years, the state has had difficulty in making investments in economic development activities for projects around the state. There's almost no funding available for any kind of job creation activities, either at the local level or at the state level. And the one thing that the local level relies on is their incentive programs. Many county commissioners say to me they'd rather have a job any day than property tax payment. And if you can get new investment and an increase in property value over the long term, you're in a better situation. So to put this sort of unknown on top of what we already operate at a time when we don't have funding to give and provide for a way to get a local business to expand, it just makes us worry about the short-term implications of all of this. And I just think this isn't a good time to be doing this. Thanks so much.
No, and thank you. And a couple things. The money available to attract or recruit that kind of development is going to decrease, by the way, after my conversation I had with some nice people yesterday, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But on the unknown part, we just had some testimony here about a $50 million project. The construction was only $2 million, and chances are all those wages were at or above prevailing wage anyway, because it was made quite clear Billy Bob can't come in and do this stuff. So I really don't think it is an unknown. I think it's very much a known. Be quite frankly, I'm not so sure this would have any impact whatsoever on any project that's happened, is happening, or is going to happen. It would just make it very clear that this state demands that our tax dollars go to living wage, family wage jobs. And I think that's a good statement. I think that's a good standard, and I support it, and I support the bill. Any questions of these very good people? All right. Thank you very much.
Just a comment. I want to thank them, the two witnesses, for the manner in which they disagreed today. It was very commendable. Thank you.
I couldn't agree more, and you were concise and to the point, and you didn't drag out a bunch of stuff that we might think it was irrelevant. I appreciate that kind of testimony as well. Thank you very much, and
thank
keep
you.
Up the good work.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Anyone else want to testify on this bill or the future coming amendment that's going in it?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Teresa.
Before we close the public hearing, I do have some written testimony from the Oregon Chamber of Commerce who wants to express their opposition to the original bill. I'll forward that. I just have an electronic copy, so I'll forward that to the members later today.
Thank you very much, and you can look forward to receiving that. Anyone else? I'm going to close the public hearing, House Bill 2699. Anything for the good of the order? Great hearing today. Very fun. We're adjourned.